Shayna, my dear.
Christopher.
You know, before the show starts, when it's just the two of us, I just noticed you were a little tight this morning, and I thought I would tell you a joke just to get you loosened up before the show.
Okay. This is going to make me writhe in agony, I'm sure, but go for it, Chris.
So do you know why the Norwegian Department of Defense paints barcodes on their battleships?
Oh, I really hesitate to ask, but why?
So that when they return to port, they can Scandinavian.
Oh, ouch. Okay, well, now I'm even tighter, but thanks for that, Chris.
Welcome to What in God's Name. She is Shayna Appel.
I don't even know who he is this morning. This is our beloved Chris Owen.
Our mission is to promote and practice conversations that use the lenses of moral philosophy, humanistic theology, and basically humanistic modes of inquiry, modes of focus into our shared common life.
To hopefully move those conversations into a place where the focus is on human thriving, human flourishing, as opposed to the divisions that lock so much of the conversation in our public square today.
The default lenses, and if you pay attention to this and listen to how conversations are framed, it's always, almost always, about political categories and economic categories. And those lenses don't help us see more deeply and more clearly into, unfortunately, what ails us,
right,
as a society, and also, how we can do better.
How we can find a shared common narrative and be a people trying to move forward with some similar aspiration.
Yeah. Indeed. We have a spinny wheel. It is part of our practice on What in God's Name to give that thing a spin. It's a piece of plywood. It has 16 different core values and key ideas. A sprinkler head, which is a pointer, lands on one of those 16 core values and key ideas. Shayna and I do a riff on it. It's anti-totalitarian practice from my point of view. Totalitarians don't like unpredictability and randomness, and our spinny wheel is unpredictable and random. And Shayna likes to think of the spinny wheel as a warm-up, which I'll go along with that, Shayna.
It's a little improvisation. It's a little improv to loosen us up.
Yep. Why don't you give that thing a spin? The spinny wheel has landed on conversationology or questioning. So, conversation is a key concept for us, Shayna, and it's a key concept really for a people that aims to be self-governing. Conversation is not debate, it's not domination, it's the giving and receiving of different ideas. And so it involves curiosity, it involves the ability to listen, it involves the ability to change your mind. All of these things, so important. And conversation, we've lost the ability to have really good conversations as a society, as a polity, and as a culture. You know, there's so many different ways to name what ails our shared common life. And this is another way to name it, which is the inability to have just conversations that point us towards discovering together what is true and what we can hold together as true.
Yeah, it makes me think about that opening paragraph in John's gospel. And everything that came into being through the word, and without the word, nothing came into being. Now, clearly, John was trying to lay forth some sort of Trinitarian theology, which I still have a hard time wrapping my head around. But if we just take it at face value and look at the power of the word and how respect for that has been totally lost, if we were to do one thing and one thing only in this country, and that is to change the public narrative and move it back to civility. And any number of people have lifted this up, or the Civility Project, and, you know, tried to lift that up. But if we were just to change the tenor of conversations on social media and out in the media and so on and so forth, you know, oratory by our leaders should raise the temperature in the room. It should make our socks roll up and down. It should, you know, bring people to their feet and inspire the best within us. And instead, we've got this blither going on in social media where, you know, Aaron Rodgers is asserting that Jimmy Kimmel was on the list, Jeffrey Epstein's list, and then saying he never said that. Like, dude, we have the videotape. So the conversationology right now in this country is at such an all-time low. And for those of us who make our living with words, it's painful.
Yeah.
It's just painful.
Yeah.
But more to the point, it really threatens to undercut our democracy, for which we need some unification and some common social narrative.
What do you think about people who say that conversation is just words and what we need is action?
How do we get to action?
I was going to say, I can answer my own question.
Go ahead. Curious.
Well, you've just kind of done it.
Well, action is what got the first lunar landing or the first, you know, human beings into outer space. But that began with a conversation. It began with a couple of guys standing out in a cornfield looking at the moon and asking themselves, do you think we could ever get somebody there? It all starts with the word.
Yeah. So thank you for that. I was just going to say, ideas have consequences.
Ideas have consequences.
Very similar, I believe, to what you just said.
And there's the tone indicating to our listeners that we are rounding a corner and turning into the meat of today's topic for discussion, for conversationology.
Our conversation today is taking as its point of departure an article written by Jean Bethke Elshtain, who died in 2013. Jean Bethke Elshtain taught at the University of Chicago. Her article is called Democratic Authority at Century's End, and we'll post the link to this article in our show notes.
A warning to our listeners, this is pretty dense reading, but absolutely worth reading.
So, Shana, I want to start, and for our listening community, just to read the first paragraph of this piece. Again, it's called Democratic Authority at Century's End. Jean Bethke Elshtain writes, there is widespread agreement that American democracy is in trouble. Social scientists offer up a mountain of data showing that we are civically depleted, politically cynical and rootless, socially mistrustful, and personally fearful. This is a strange turn of events for a country associated with can-do optimism, with a robust democratic faith. Indeed, a country once quite confident about its institutions and its ability to transmit them intact over time. An anemic and faltering democratic faith, a decline of confidence in our basic institutions, threatens to render us incapable of sustaining these institutions over the long haul.
And let's just remember, this was written when, Chris?
This was written in the spring of 2000.
Yeah.
One remarkable comment about that, Shana, is when she talks about how we are personally fearful in this country. And it's written, she writes that before 9/11.
Right.
Before 9/11.
Right.
So let's just pause on this, even just this, for a second. It's 2024. This is almost a quarter of a century old, this writing. And so here's the takeaway for me on this.
I just realized I'm old. Okay. This was a quarter century. This was written a quarter century ago. Yeah.
Yeah.
9/11 was almost that long ago.
So this is what I want to say about how old this article is, which is these things that she names have been, let's say, festering. They've been part of the body for a long time. For a long time. Because, of course, they predate 2000. I mean,
right.
She's able to write this because she's been observing this
right.
for a while as well. So, in a way, the upshot of the upshot is, how can it be surprising that we are where we are?
Well, it's also so, you know, it echoes, for me, it echoes the criticism that was being raised about postmodernity. Mm. And at the time,
yes,
you know, we were wrestling with postmodernity. We were postmodern, but we were not yet into what was going to follow modernity. We were in a sort of liminal zone.
Yes.
I'm not sure we've come out of it yet.
Yes.
You know, there was, it was largely marked by the introduction of the internet and has continued forward to social media and now artificial intelligence. And there has not been a real public reckoning of postmodernity. So I still feel like, you know, 25 years later, we're still in postmodernity. We have not landed. And maybe that has something to do with some of the unsettled nature of what we're dealing with.
Can we land on this for a second?
We could.
Because she does, Jean Bethke Elshtain does actually touch on this in her article. But postmodernity, do you have a quick and dirty definition of that? And if not, I can take a stab at it. Just to help our listening community, like when we're talking about a postmodern moment, what is it? How does that affect us?
Well, we have to think about where we were as a nation at the end of the industrial age. And at the end of the industrial age, we enter a period social scientists call modernity.
Yep.
And that's an age of discovery.
Yep.
Really. Marked by a lot of discovery, a lot of advances in medicine and science.
So, yep.
And all of that.
And a certain kind of confidence and certainty.
Well, it comes with feeling pretty good about what we're accomplishing.
Yes.
And the directions that we're moving in.
And what's made invisible in that moment is the cost to marginalized people, for example, women, for example, and
BIPOC
and many others.
Alphabet
and many
City,
others.
Sure.
Yeah. So my understanding of postmodernity is that it's this philosophical movement to deconstruct the certainties on which that very confident world was built. And so it's a critique of traditions that have been handed down, that the dark side of it,
yeah,
of postmodernity is that it overshot the mark, to use a phrase that you use sometimes, which is by critiquing the meanings of things, it critiqued basically the meaning of everything. And so overshooting the mark ended in a moral relativism, which is where we are today. Like truth doesn't matter. Everything is
relative. That's
relative,
just your
and
truth.
Subjective. It's
right.
Just your truth. So these are the, this is the, le- so I did try to paint it in a positive light because there was and still is positive critique to be done of, let's just say in shorthand, traditional morality.
But generally speaking, if you're going to deconstruct something, it is very helpful to have some idea of what you want to reconstruct on the other end of it.
Right.
That seems to have been lacking. And so we've been in a 25 years for a quarter of a century. We have been deconstructing and not reconstructing any of this.
Right.
Now, you know,
And a piece of what's deconstructed, to bring it back to Jean Bethke Elshtain's article, is authority.
Yes.
She talks about the erosion of authority. But I cut you off.
Let's go there. Because authority in the way that she's using the word has to do with really sort of the source of authority.
Yes.
The source of authority emanates from a person's being bound to something larger than them.
Ah, you got it.
And when we see that in someone, we recognize it immediately. Even somebody, you look at somebody like a Martin Luther King.
Yes.
A Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, who did not have authority given to him by the government, right? It's, he didn't go out for an elected position. That wasn't the source of his authority. Right. His authority came from a deeply rooted conviction that that this nation could not possibly ever thrive as long as people, in particular African-American people, black people in this nation were under the boot of white America. As long as institutional racism existed, there was no hope. It was a deep conviction for the betterment of all people. And of course, as a man of God, whether people were religious or not almost didn't matter. He just transmitted that authority by virtue of who he was being.
Yes.
When he stood up and spoke, when he led people in demonstrations, his convictions came from a higher source.
Yeah. Yeah. He was, I'll just say the same thing, but somewhat differently. His authority, he was connected to the higher power, the higher source, and he was able to remind others
yes.
of it
yes.
and connect them to it as well. And so that gets to the sense of that there's a common, there's some kind of, in this story, right, that you're telling, there's some kind of common higher authority, a higher good, a vision of human flourishing that is held together in common so that there's a common frame of reference from which then to act.
And I'm going to say something somewhat radical in the sense that it's a throwback. That one of the brilliance, the part about Dr. King's ministry, which I so deeply appreciated and which has shaped so much of my own, was his ability to hold together both the scriptures and the nation's constitution. Mm-hmm. In other words, the fact that the American dream, the vision of America as this great nation on a hill, a light and a beacon unto all nations, despite the fact that clearly that was a dream and not something that we had actually manifested. He didn't throw the baby out with the bathwater. Right. He held us to that dream, to that vision. And it was hopeful. And it inspired people to want to do and to be more. It inspired people to sacrifice and to risk for something what? Greater than ourselves.
Yeah. You know, what's really interesting about what you just said, Shana, to me is, well, there's a lot I could say because it's very interesting, but sometimes now we think of the Constitution as just a bunch of procedures, and your example of Dr. King, the Reverend Dr. King, being able to connect a higher good and the Constitution is surfacing. The Constitution isn't just a bunch of procedures, but that it also, as a document, contains a vision of the good, and so I'll yeah, well, stop there.
It reminds me of, you know, people who read the Bible and say, well, that could never have happened, right? I mean, Jesus didn't actually walk on water. He did, you know. And we say, well, my instruction, the way I teach Bible is, don't, if you ask the question, did it happen or not happen, the only answers you can come up with are yes or no. And neither of those are very inspirational. If you want to get to the meat, if you want to get to the heart, the pulse, the gold, the juice of Scripture, you have to constantly ask yourself, what was the writer trying to say? And I think the same thing is true of the Constitution. And, you know, some of this is because I just saw Hamilton for the first time the other night with my friend Adam was up visiting and we watched it on TV. But to really understand what was in the hearts and minds, what was the aspiration, what were they reaching for when they did a very crazy thing, right? Which was to take on to take on King George and to take on this. We were outgunned. We were outmanned. We were out everything. But there was an ideal that they thought was worth dying for. What the hell has happened to that ideal? Oh, it's awash in a sea of relativism where it's like, well, that may be your ideal, but it isn't. So we have no common.
Yeah.
I mean, I think we still do.
Yeah.
I think we're in denial about our common aspirations. And I think we're lacking the leadership to help illuminate that common aspiration. But I do believe that human beings as such fundamentally want to thrive, want to be safe, want to, understand that if this planet is destroyed, we've got no place else to go. I mean, yes, there are plenty of people who are in denial of that. You want to move on?
I'd like to talk a little bit more about authority versus power, because
that's a great conversation to be having today.
Indeed,
the day is, after the hearing on how much authority or how much power the president of the United States actually has.
Yeah, yeah.
No, he's immune from all prosecution for anything he does while he's the president.
Right, right. So this picks up on something that you said, but another way to define authority, and this is not in Elstein's article, but I just remembered it, although she alludes to something like this. Authority is the ability to exercise power without coercion or violence. Because then she talks about, I don't know if this is where you're going, Shana, but then Elstein talks about, she talks about Mao in China, who said famously, power grows out of the barrel of a gun. And Elstein says, no, violence grows out of the barrel of a gun, not power.
And I'm going to go back to Martin Luther King for a moment, who said, power without love is reckless and abusive, and love without power is sentimental and anemic. Power at its best is love implementing the demands of justice, and justice at its best is power correcting everything that stands against love. Those are parallel statements right there, you know, that, and we recognize it when we see it, we just haven't seen it in a while.
So Elstein goes on to argue that, and maybe I'm going to get too far ahead of the story and you can pull me back, but she's just going to go on to argue that for there to be something other than just coercive power, my will against your will, might makes right, for there to be something other than that, and the other of that would be genuine authority, there needs to be, and this is back to an earlier part of this conversation that you and I had, there has to be a vision of the good that people hold in common.
Right. And on that, she refers to, and I don't know how to pronounce this person, Arendt?
Yeah, Arendt.
Arendt.
Hannah Arendt, yeah.
So Elstein refers to a work by Hannah Arendt. Authority, she claimed, has vanished from the modern world since we can no longer fall back upon authentic and indisputable experiences common to all. The very term has become clouded by controversy and confusion. And then Elstein writes that for now it's important to note that we need the deep and wide sharing of an overarching as well as grounding set of experiences of labor, work, and action to fall back upon. And if we don't have this, authority vanishes. And that's what we've lost, you know, that there are no common experiences, or that for one person's experience to be right, mine has to be wrong. That's not true. Both experiences can exist and do exist. And now we're, you know, in the midst of this cancel culture and people trying to silence any discussion about what actually happened in the course of American history so that we can paint some narrative that speaks to a very small segment of the American population and leaves the vast majority of people out and then raises the temperature of the fight. I don't know how we get out of this. I mean,
well, that's funny. I'm sorry, I shouldn't be laughing because it's no laughing matter. But I'm laughing because, as usual, you are anticipating kind of my train of thought, which is, and I'm just going to ask this provocatively of you with a little bit of a preface. So the preface is, the S1 project of what of which the What in God's Name podcast is a part. Our project is, one way to understand it is, the recovery of this vision of, or at least conversations about it. It's not like we have the vision and we're going to lay it out there, but raising the people's consciousness that we have to have conversations about these things as a society.
Exactly.
So that's getting to the bone of what the S1 Project is about. Now, are we naive to be doing this? Is our society so far gone? Have so many people just let go of the rope on this kind of question, let go of the rope on democracy, let go of the rope on being self-governing in any meaningful way? Naive to do this? I don't think so. I'm going to answer my question.
I'll wear the badge. Yeah. I'll wear the badge of naive and I'll wear it proudly. Yeah. Naive is just an idea unbound by the constraints of actualizing. And so often the great idea is tanked way too early rather than explore the idea fully and find the merits of it and give it time to light people's hearts on fire, at which point anything becomes possible, we move into a place of an enactment, right? And what are the complications of enacting that idea? And I think in my worldview, the greatest leaders among us have been among the most naive.
Right.
What the hell did Jesus think he was doing?
Yes.
What the hell did Martin Luther King or Mahatma Gandhi or Mother Teresa, right, for that matter, what did Rosa Parks think she was doing, she was going to accomplish by sitting on the bus? Did she have a full plan for what was coming? Some have argued there was a plan in place. Others have said, no, she was just tired. She herself said she was just tired. So she sat down. So I think allowing ourselves to come back to that idealistic naivety is not necessarily a bad thing. In fact, I'd argue it's necessary. Naivety is where, don't awe and wonder dwell some way, shape, or form in naivety? And without that, what do you have? You have a level of humanism devoid of any appreciation for anything bigger than anything. And as Elstein says, at that point, our humanistic ideology becomes less than human.
Yeah.
It's not humanistic anymore.
Yeah. Naive is a word that's tossed in by the cynics.
Gets a bad rap.
By the cynics who want to tear things down ahead of time. Yeah. I liked how you said that. Yeah. And so it's a daunting task. There's no question. But it's worth. I mean, ideas have consequences. This is how we started. Conversationality. Conversation, the power of it. Ideas have consequences. Bad ideas have bad consequences. And good ideas have good consequences. And so
But talking is something we can all do. And I know so many people out there are so frustrated right now about feeling powerless over this wrecking ball that seems to be sweeping through America. We're not powerless. And I've seen this before in family systems where somebody comes out of a massively toxic family system and ends it with them. Kids who grow up in households with abusive parents, with alcoholic and drug addicted parents, and who turn it around in one generation and it stops. And their children will have a very different experience of this life because they did a thing, just one thing, right? So culture, our culture encourages us to the big and that, well, you know, if you're not Gates, you can't do, you know, anything because you need millions of dollars and you have to make this big splash on it. But no, you don't. It starts with us and it grows one at a time. And each time we look around, there's one more at the table and the conversation grows. And that is, I believe, how it's going to change. Again, everything that is going to come into being is going to come into being through the word. And without the word, nothing's coming into being. So if we can't speak some sort of common narrative and a common aspiration back into our common life, we're going to be adrift on this sea of relativity. And it's not, as I think most of us would agree, a particularly satisfying, happy, fulfilling place to be. Thereth endeth the sermon.
I love it, Shana. Thank you. Are we there? I mean, there's so much more to say, but...
Oh my God, this is, this article, I'm telling you, this is, I just have to say one more thing, because this one was, and this is kind of goes to naivety. Can anything really be changed by the word? Well, you know, maybe if we pay attention, right? Because Elstein wrote in this article, again, written in 2000, she was writing about legitimate authoritative figures. Again, that's a person who is bound to something bigger than themselves. She says, in the absence of that, we wind up with, for example, she was using a 20th century tyrant, a Hitler or a Stalin. Here's the description. Who knows and recognizes neither the laws of God, nor of nature, nor of human decency, and makes himself a law unto himself. Hence, an enactor of capricious terror and violence. If that is not a slam dunk description of Donald Trump, then please, listeners, write into our website. Let us know what your description is. But when I read that, I just about fell out of my chair. This is what happens when you have an what we call today in the lexicon of our day is unhinged. He is unhinged. He is not hinged to anything other than himself.
Unbound.
Right?
Unbound.
Unbound. Unbound. And so there we have it. I want to end on a higher note.
Okay.
Can we do that?
We can do it.
Can I just end with the paragraph that she closes with?
Yes.
Because I think it's a great one.
Thanks. Yep.
She writes, in late modernity, we have all become self-pleasers, and self-pleasers cannot sustain institutional forms. For that seems nothing but the imposition of unacceptable constraint on a subject deemed sovereign. We've talked about this, right? The toxic individuality. Yeah. She goes on, so we're in the soup. We lament that our center does not hold, but we will not permit ourselves to be held, so to speak. Our political commitments are thin. Our religious commitments increasingly chafe under any constraint. Thus, we daily surrender a bit more of the pluralistic, communal, formative dimension of that world known as the American democracy, one that requires institutional robustness of considerable variety. We are all alone with our freedom and coerced in ways beyond our imaginings. We may well and truly be approaching the moment Hannah Arendt dreaded, the moment when the actions of free citizens and the power they create when they come together is a frozen tableau from a lost time and place rather than an ever-present possibility. Now, I know that sounds dire, so where's the hope? And, you know, at the risk of self-aggrandizing, friends, the S1 Project is a real thing. It is out here in the world, and we are working to change that very construct, the very grounding of our being. And we believe that it can be done in part in conversation. Yes, conversation needs to lead to some sort of action and some sort of change in the individual and in the collective, but it will begin with conversation. And so I just want to thank our listeners for tuning in today. Want to encourage you to check out our new website when it's up, which should be soon, according to my partner, Chris, and to stay engaged in this project. It is something you can do in the privacy of your own home. It is something you can do with your friends and neighbors to begin a different conversation. And we're going to hopefully help one another figure out how to break out of the constraints that are binding that conversation currently. So stay tuned.
Shana, so grateful to be able to think and talk with you.
And with you,
using,
Chris.
Using the lenses of moral philosophy and humanistic theology.
Amen.
It's thank you.
Well, you were the brains behind this project, Chris, so I'm just happy to be along for the ride.
Be curious, Shana.
Go deep, Chris.
And shine light. Our show today is brought to you by our generous donors on Patreon. You can become one of our generous donors on Patreon by going to, Patreon. And
Patreon.org, yes?
Yes, indeed.
Patreon.org.
Great to be with you today, Shana.
Great to be with you, Christopher.